Hey, yo, what is a cypher?
If you didn't know where the park was and you heard that thump, you knew where to go.
The knowledge of the cypher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cypher come from?
The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cypher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cypher, a weekly podcast bringing you talks with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sotero. This is episode 207, a talk with Ron Amon-Ra Lawrence. Ron is a producer who is best known for his time as part of Bad Boy Records' Hitmen Production Collective. Ron, along with his friend, production partner, and Cypher episode 21 guest, Derek Angeletti, teamed up with Diddy, Stevie J, and Nasheem Myrick to create iconic hits for Biggie, Mace, Diddy, Faith Evans, Mary J. Blige, The Lox, and many more. After that run ended, Ron made beats for the likes of Beyonce, Aretha Franklin, and Luther Vandross. Oh, and I would be remiss if I didn't mention what he was doing before Bad Boy. He had a group with Angeletti called Two Kings and a Cypher. It's a duo that has had a big influence on this very show, as you'll hear in just a minute. Ron is also a hip-hop historian and documentarian, and has made several films dealing with unjustly ignored aspects of hip-hop's history. Most notable among these is the documentary Founding Fathers, which deals with the mobile DJ scene of the 1970s in Brooklyn and Queens. Any fan of the genre needs to see the movie in order to understand that there was a lot more to DJing in that era than just what was happening in the Bronx. We talked to Ron Lawrence at Crosstown Studios in Harlem. If you like the show, please check out our Patreon at patreon.com/thecyphershow. It helps us foot our legal bills, and we've recently updated our rewards with some crazy new stuff. If you want to know any of the songs we're playing during this episode, visit thecyphershow.com to find a complete list and the show notes. While you're there, sign up for our monthly newsletter to stay on top of what's going on with The Cypher. And now, here's the man who hypnotized Biggie, Ron Amon-Ra Lawrence. Ron Lawrence, yes. thanks for coming by. I appreciate it. When I knew I was going to have you on the show, you know, I was looking around, reminding myself what you had done, you know, over the years. And obviously there was a whole bunch. You know, I found myself on eBay and I could not resist getting this and I wanted to show it to you.
Wow. How'd you find this?
Just on eBay. So for people who can't see, obviously, that is the unfortunately fictional group, the Mau Maus, and their single Black is Black. That's B-L-A-K from the movie Bamboozled.
M-A-U,
already about to attack the track. Black is black. Well, how black?
Black heart, black mind, black soul.
Mau Maus.
He was born to roll.
Who the crew?
M-A-U, M-A-U,
ain't fire. About to attack the track.
But black is black.
How black?
Black boom to be reached the black hearse.
Was black? Yow.
Shaded yow.
Great song produced by Ron Lawrence.
That is correct.
Yeah. So what? Yes. Bamboozled is, by the way, one of my favorite movies. I think it's brilliant and was incredibly underappreciated. You were in the movie also?
Yeah, I was in the movie. I had a very, very small part. I had a little more, but they, I guess, didn't have enough time.
Yeah.
So they cut it out. The part of me in the movie is so small that you probably miss it. Mm-hmm. But I play the engineer in the movie.
Right here.
What's that, though? What's that?
It's black is black.
I got production credit for it.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
What do you remember about making that song?
Wow. Quite interesting because it was so many different people.
Right.
So many different rappers, you know, coming together to make this record work. And they were also actors in the movie. Yeah, Mos Def, Cannabis, Charlie Baltimore, MC Search, DJ Scratch, Mums, and Gano Grills. And this was around the time before Mos Def actually blew up. And Cannabis, this was around the time he was having that beef with LL Cool J.
Yeah.
It was just great to just be a part of this whole situation and just having the credit for a soundtrack to a movie. Because I did more than just this. I actually did the source score to the movie.
Oh.
Yeah, which I didn't get credit for. It was omitted for some reason. But yeah, if you see the movie and if you see some of the hip-hop production work, that's actually That's my stuff.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Like I said, it's one of my favorite movies, and it was great. You know?
Yeah, and I don't, you know, the thing is, I don't even own a copy of this, the actual vinyl.
Yeah.
I didn't even know it existed.
Yeah. They're pretty inexpensive on eBay. So before you leave, I'll show you where to find it.
That's actually cool.
Yeah.
I like this.
Yeah. I don't know how familiar you are with our show, but the very first sound you hear in every single episode actually comes from your group.
That's right.
From Two Kings and a Cypher.
Yes.
Derek saying, Ayo, what is a cypher?
Yes.
Ayo, what is a cypher? 360 degrees, a cycle, a square, a circle, completion.
We used just that little bit for the intro, but we wanted to ask the expert, well, what is a cypher?
360 degrees. That's a circle, pretty much. But, you know, the term cypher, it was very well used in the Nation of Islam,
mm-hmm.
which the 5% nation was an offshoot from.
Right.
And that's where, you know, the whole cypher thing comes from. And, you know, we were Two Kings in the cypher.
Of course. And so I know that you had some relationship with the 5% Nation growing up. Is that true?
Early on, yes. As a teenager. Actually, before I came to Howard University. Yeah.
But then your manager for Two Kings in a cypher was very, Haq Islam was very involved in the Nation of Islam, right?
Yeah, but he also was a 5% as well. Yeah. And then he moved on to the Nation of Islam later on.
How'd you hook up with him? Was he in school with you or?
Yeah, he went to Howard University as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And, you know, I had a setup in the dorm room. I was like probably the only person at Howard University at the time to have equipment.
Mm-hmm.
I had gotten the MPC 60. I had a M1 keyboard and I had a Tascam 4-track. And I'll create beats and demos. Me and D-Dot, we were working on Two Kings and a Cypher demo at the time. And a friend of mine introduced me to Haq. He brought Haq to the dorm room and Haq heard the stuff and he was interested. At the time, Haq was, he was doing A&R for Philadelphia International with Kenny Gamble and Leon Huff.
Right.
International is a label founded in 1971 by writer-producers Gamble and Huff. It was the home of the lushly arranged sound that came to be known as Philly Soul. Some of the label's most popular acts were Patti LaBelle, Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes and their lead singer Teddy Pendergrass, and the OJs. The label's house band also had hits on their own under the name MFSB.
It was a very interesting situation. Just to be able to be a part of that, It was great.
You didn't sign with Philly International, but you recorded in their studios and sort of hung out there, right?
Yeah, we recorded, because of the connection. I mean, there's a whole story behind that, but, you know, we would travel back and forth because we were living in D.C. at the time. So we had to travel every other week to go to Philadelphia, and then we would sleep on Haq's floors. Yeah, but the studio, it was a great experience just working with Kenny Gamble and working with all the writers that were around at the time that used to come to the studio, and a lot of them had wrote a lot of the hits for Philadelphia International, but they were still hanging around. But we got to meet all of them. And, you know, just to be able to meet some of those writers who wrote a lot of those hits for Stylistics. Hurry up this way again. Spinners. Mm-hmm. Whenever you call me, I'll be there. They were all there.
Yeah.
Man, that was just quite an experience.
What did you pick up? Any lessons you remember in particular from, as Derek refers to them, Mr. Gamble and Mr. Huff?
Yeah, well, what I picked up from Kenny was the fact that when he would come in to listen to our stuff,
mm-hmm.
but he would listen to it very low. He would like turn down the knob and he would listen low. And I was trying to figure out why he would do that. And then, you know, he told me he was checking for like to see how the vocals would feel on top of the music. So when you listen to it very low, you should be able to hear almost everything in the best form, you know, even if it's a little hi-hat. And then he would turn it up and then turn it down low again, you know, and then he would listen to it from a, I think it's called a quarter inch. When you go to, I think it's after you go straight to, once the song is ready to go to mix,
mm-hmm.
they go to quarter inch tape.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that's what you call it. And it's like a little small speaker. Mono speaker that you would listen to the music, and the music was so truthful. That's like the best way that you can actually hear a mix, because you can hear everything coming out of that little speaker. So what I learned from that was, like, you know, the cheapest speakers that you could listen to mix to would be the best way to tell the truth on what a song should really sound like.
So tell me a little bit about Two Kings and a Cypher, because you guys made a great album.
Ladies and gentlemen, presenting Armin Ron, D.O.P.
Yo, this beat's rather funky.
Indeed it is.
Mm.
Shall we?
Who shall begin?
Flip a coin.
Heads or tails, we'll see.
After you,
so
Ra.
After you, D.O.P.
Yippee, yippee, yay, yippee, yi, yi, yo. All praise due to the kings of TKO.
It's a moonlit night as I walk and wonder, cause I can't understand the spell you got me under. I know I don't deserve the love that you're giving, but you're every reason I'm living.
Some singles before you broke up and got more into production. How'd you guys decide to form a group in the first place, you and Derek?
Early on, like I came from a neighborhood that very influential in the music industry
right.
as time went on.
East Elmhurst,
yes, right? Yes, so I was, yeah. I was around a lot of that. And, you know, I had a lot of connections. And at the time, the only person that I really saw that was serious about it was Derek.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I had approached him and said, yo, let's put something together. Let's start a group. And yeah. he was down.
And the way he broke it down, I was curious if you had the same impression, was that you each did both lyrics and music, but he was primarily a lyrics guy and you were primarily a music guy. Is that an assessment that you agree with?
Yeah. I mean, but I was lyrics first. But the fact that we didn't have a producer,
mm-hmm.
that was the reason why I got into production, because we needed somebody to make the beats.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, lyrically, he was better than I was. So I kind of gravitated more to the production. Yeah. And because we needed a producer, and that's how I got into it. So what I did was I went to the administrative building and I took a loan out. I think it was for like $600. It's like an emergency student loan. And I took it. I bought this big boombox radio, which had two microphones on it. And we started that way. And then I had this small little radio and I would play the music from the small radio and I would record from the boombox.
You would do your vocals into the...
Exactly, yeah.
Into the boombox on top of the end of recording
right,
music
right.
and your vocals.
And that's how we started off. And then a partner of mine across the street, he had an MPC 1200, a drum machine. So we would go over to his place and we would tell him what we want and then he would create the beat.
You mentioned Queens.
Mm-hmm.
Your brother was a DJ, right?
Yes.
Tell me about that when, you know, being around him growing up and seeing him spin at places. What was that like?
Yeah, well, that was the first time I ever figured out what a DJ was. Mm-hmm. You know, this was like back in 74, 75. And he had a console and it was built by Richard Long.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Richard Long was a physician, mathematician guy. And he understood sound. He understood physics and acoustics, and he would build systems across New York City, like Studio 54, The Garage, like all these big clubs across New York, and he was very popular.
It's not quite possible to state how important Richard Long was to the development of live club sound and consequently several different genres of music. His systems were known for huge and round bass with hard-hitting sound where low frequencies were felt more than heard. In New York City, his home base was the Paradise Garage, where he worked with the legendary DJ Larry Levan to continuously tweak the sound and his talents to greatest effect. Among the other famous clubs he put systems in included Studio 54, Area, Bonds International Casino, Zanzibar in Newark, New Jersey, and several international nightclubs. He also put a system in the Box and Warehouse in Chicago, where another legendary DJ, Frankie Knuckles, who had worked with Levan and Long previously, effectively led to the birth of house music on the Long system. As of 2015, the only remaining functional Richard Long system is at the El Dorado Auto Scooter Bumper Cars in Coney Island. Yep, bumper cars.
So my brother got a connection to him and talked to him about building a sound system for him, but he wanted to take it to the street. This was around the first time that I think something like that had ever been done. So my brother had like a mobile system on wheels. He had the console. He had the Bertha speakers, all the speakers that Richard Long had set up in the clubs. My brother had a set of that. And my brother, he would give it to my brother to test them out in the streets. Huh. Yeah. So my brother had a state of the art sound system back then. So when he would come out and play, he would blow everybody out because he had the perfect sound, bass, mid-range, highs. When everybody had to like connect their stuff with wires, my brother's stuff was already set up. It was just, all he had to do was just put three or four pieces together and he was ready to go.
Wow.
Yeah.
And you mentioned Bertha speaker. Is that a specific type of speaker, or is it just kind of a generic name for big but portable speakers?
No, the Bertha speaker is a speaker that Richard Long designed and created. Okay. He called it the Bertha. Now, some people may say they have Berthas and all that stuff. That's a fib. If it wasn't built from Richard Long, mm-hmm. custom built, it wasn't the Bertha.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Now, they had earthquake speakers. Mm-hmm. I think those were made by JBL. Mm-hmm. But Richard Long had his version, which was custom. You couldn't buy those in the store.
Wow. You know, obviously this mobile DJ thing, your brother was not the only DJ in the neighborhood. In fact, there's, you know, a whole scene going on that you eventually made a movie about. Give me an impression of that. How often would people be spinning outdoors while you were growing up? What kind of events? Where would DJs be playing at? What were the events like?
Okay, well, they would come out just for the fun of it mm-hmm. because it was like a nice day. And it was like, yo, let's go jam in a park. I mean, the first time I saw it was 1973. I was a little kid when they first came out to 127 Park. I must have been like, I don't know, maybe like first grade or something like that. And that was my first experience of it. And my brother, his first sight was seeing that was over on Eastern Parkway. He was looking at DJs like Maboya and Grandmaster Flowers.
1-2, 1-2, 1-2, New York City. Right now you're listening to the sounds of the Grandmaster Flowers on your mind, eh? With the voice of a 1-8 cool.
Razz Maboya and Cameron Grandmaster Flowers were pioneering mobile DJs in the late 1960s and early 1970s who would perform at spots like Reese Park and the Rockaways, Prospect Heights, St. Mark's Park, assorted Brooklyn schoolyards, and Prospect Park.
Hip hop without stop. I put my foot on the ride. I say hip hop, hip hip hop, hop hop, hip hip. I do stop, dig a dang, dig a dang, dig a dang, 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 dig a dang, dig a ba ba ooh. That right.
And those guys, and then he picked it up from there. He saw them do it because my family were from the Caribbean, so we would go out to Eastern Parkway every year for Labor Day Parade.
Right,
and they would set up while they had the bands playing, and that was my brother's experience of seeing that. So. That's why he got a sound system. But they would come out in the parks if it was a nice day, and they would set up, and people would look forward to going. But you would hear the bass, all you would hear was the thump, and then you would just follow the thump. You could be a mile away, and you could just hear that bottom like boom, 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 and you would follow the thump. If you didn't know where the park was, and then you heard that thump, you knew where to go.
Yeah,
yeah. So people used to come from all over. Uh-huh. We're from East Elmhurst, Queens, and that's like where the LaGuardia Airport is located. It's like within walking distance. But people will come from Jamaica, Queens. They will come from Brooklyn, wherever. They would just come, and it would be just like a crowd of people. Then you have like hot dog stands. You have the ice cream man with Park, Mr. Softy, and everybody would come out, and we just have a good time. And it would go till late night. But I would hang out with my brother because my mother would let me because I was with him.
Right.
So I was able to experience a lot of that when I was young, 1976, 77, 78. And sometimes he would take me places with him.
When do you first remember MCs or rappers on the microphone in those situations kind of rhyming?
Well, the way they did it back then in Queens, like 76, they would say stuff like, put your foot on a rock, pat your foot, don't stop, or hoo-ha, somebody move your car, or this and that. Or they would talk like Dracula or something,
Yeah.
But they were kind of like imitating like a lot of those radio jocks. Mm-hmm. They would listen to the radio jocks, and those radio jocks would kind of like put like certain flavors to their voice. And and they wanted to mimic that. They wanted to copy that, So I think once people started putting rhymes together, a lot of them sounded like that. But I guess what made this situation unique is when they did it in the Bronx, they changed it. They tweaked it and gave it a unique style. So when you heard guys like Melly Mel come out, they just took it to another level.
A child is born with no state of mind, blind to the ways of mankind. God is smiling on you, but he's frowning too, because only God knows what you'll go through. You'll grow in the ghetto, living second rate.
Yeah, they just took to it. It was just like, okay, well, this is what I want to do.
So an influential early producer you got to know very well was Herbie Lovebug. When did you meet him?
I must have been about maybe 12 or 13 when I met Herbie, yeah. Because Herbie went to a Catholic school literally up the street from where I live. I lived on 97th Street. The Catholic street was at the corner of my block. So Herbie Lovebug went there, Kwame went there, Coogee Rap went there. And this Catholic school went up to eighth grade. So one of Herbie's friends lived on my block. They went to the same Catholic school with him. That's when they were playing with like, superhero dolls and stuff like that. And he had this doll called Cyborg. That's what I remember.
Right.
But yeah, but that's when, you know, we became friends. And but we were into music. We weren't doing the MC thing at the time.
Right.
But later on, you know, we got into the whole group thing, you know.
Yeah, he started producing, obviously working with Kwame, working with Salt and Pepper, and you were around for a lot of that stuff.
Yeah, but before that, we were in the same rap group. We had rap groups together.
Oh.
Yeah, there was a big rap group scene in East Elmhurst.
Wow. What was the name of your group?
Well, I was in the Turnout Brothers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was in the Turnout Brothers. It was me, Rockin' B, Clevio, and the Kid Kool Out. The Kid Kool Out was Kid from Kid and Play. Yeah. So we were rival groups. There was another group called the Super Lovers, and that was Herbie Lovebug, Play from Kid and Play, Prince Charm, and Romeo. I became a part of the Super Lovers a little later on. We actually did a record, too. We recorded a record called The Lover's Law back in, like, 1983.
Time is now, and right here's the place for all the hangovers of our race. We're here to talk about love and how it's used when in the wrong heart, how it's abused. People walk around.
But we were, you know, as the Turnout Brothers, we would do shows. Matter of fact, Cedar Vine, who was the radio host for the... On WHBI, the world's famous Supreme Team show. He lived like about four houses down from me, the same block and I did. And I gave him a tape of the Turnout Brothers, and then he put it on his show. Yeah. So then we were able to go on his show and did a routine live, and we got to meet the Force MDs. And the Force MDs and the Turnout Brothers started doing shows together. So I remember we did a show in Mount Vernon. I remember we did a show in Brooklyn. We did a show at USA Roller Skating Ring, which I have a flyer of. But yeah, we got to know the Force MDs early on. And Jesse D, who was he was actually the opening act for the Force MDs. He was a comedian at the time before Jesse became a part of the group.
And so when did you start like really working with Herbie after he'd established himself as a producer? Probably like 86, 87, somewhere around there. You were in college or?
Yeah, I was in college because he left the group, the Super Lovers, because after Salt and Pepper blew up, he didn't really want to have anything to do with that anymore. He was like, well, you know, this is what I'm doing now. And then Kid and Play, they had their group called the Fresh Force, and they were doing their thing.
Fresh Force cooling out here with my main man, DJ Casanova. We want to know y'all down to rock with us.
And it was just me and the other guy left in the group. Prince, but he changed his name to Sundance. So we were the only two left in the group. And I always wanted to make a rap record. That was like my dream, to be on the radio, Mr. Magic. And so I kept doing it. I didn't want to stop. But the problem I was having was that I had everybody started doing their thing and I really didn't have anywhere to turn.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to college. I was just like, you know, I'm just going to go ahead to go to Howard University because, you know, I kind of felt left out.
Right.
But I kept in touch with Herbie after Salt and Pepper blew up, and I was around the whole go-go scene.
Mm-hmm.
So I started sending him records and stuff that I thought was kind of hot. I was like, yo, this is go-go breaks. Yo, you should check this out. And I sent him this groove. I don't want to say the name of it because I don't know if the song's clear. I mean, I don't know.
Right.
But I would send him go-go grooves, and then he'd turn them into records.
And so one of those ended up on My Mic Sounds Nice, right?
Exactly. My Mic Sound Nice, the go-go groove was one of the things that I had sent to him.
Right.
So when, you know, summer breaks would come around, I would come to his place and we would kind of just mess around with stuff. But I remember we had worked closely on I'll Take Your Man.
Salt and Pepper's back and we came to out-rap you, so get out my face before I smack you, ho, don't you know? Can't you understand? If you mess with me, I'll take your man.
I was instrumental in that, but I wasn't really punching any keys on a drum machine or anything like that or hitting any pads. But I was just making sounds with my mouth like, yo, this drum pad will sound dope. Like, and then he would just like, ah, yo, okay, cool. Let me just go ahead and he would repeat what I would do on a drum machine. Mm. And he would create a beat. And that became I'll Take Your Man. But he lushed it out. He hooked it up. That part I had nothing to do with.
Right.
He took the record to a whole nother level and he put everything to it and the song just became a monster.
Amazing. And so back at college, you formed TKO.
Right. But before that,
mm-hmm.
before that, when I was still wanting to make this record,
mm-hmm.
well, Herbie Lovebug had gotten a production deal from Eddie O'Loughlin,
mm-hmm.
who was the CEO of Next Plateau Records, mm-hmm. which Salt and Pepper was signed to.
Right.
Yeah. He had produced a song called Doctor's Orders way back in the 1970s. Yeah, but he had given Herbie a production deal, and Herbie did an album called Herbie's Machine, which the first single on that album was Push It.
Push It.
And we did a song, my partner and I, we were the last two members of the Super Lovers. After everybody went on to do their thing, he decided to group us together, and we did a song called Let the Drummer Get Ill.
So let the drummer get ill. So shall it be done, like Moses the prophet, I'm the chosen one to command part of the band with my amendment. That's my commandment, so get on the good foot to the Ronnie.
And we were titled Under the Super Lovers, and it was on the compilation. So that was the time I was like, okay, now I'm hearing it on Mr. Magic and Marley Marshall. So I really felt good. I was like, wow, they played my joint. But out of maybe like 8 to 10 records that was on the album, that was the one that they played.
Wow.
So it felt good to hear that.
Yeah, that's amazing. I didn't realize you're on that compilation. It's awesome. So with TKO, you do one album, but then that was it, one album, and I think a single or two. Are there any unreleased songs in the can still?
Oh, yeah, man, we got a whole album because we were supposed to put out a second album,
mm.
but the record label, they got dropped. So when they got dropped, then we got dropped.
Mm.
Yeah, so our sophomore album never came out.
Wow. Any chance of that stuff seeing the light of day sometime?
I don't know. It's possible.
I wanted to ask about one specific TKO song that I really love that is funny but also serious, which is Daffy Was a Black Man.
Whatever the reasoning for rap seasoning, they thought we were dumb, got slick and picked the chicken wing. Painted it black, called it a mallet duck, but mallet ducks are great. So now what's up?
And the brother. Can you tell me about the genesis of that tune, both musically and lyrically, and finding all the crazy cartoon samples?
Yeah, originally I had the samples in the record. The actual samples,
mm-hmm.
but we couldn't get it cleared because it was owned by Warner Brothers, and it was just I had took different parts of like different cartoons, like Daffy Duck, mm-hmm. Porky Pig, and all these other characters, and it was like just like a no go. So we had to get a voice impersonations. Like somebody had to come in there and yeah, and do the impersonations of the samples. The actual sample sounded a lot better because mm-hmm. it was very authentic.
How'd the concept for that song come about? Was that something you guys would just sort of talk about when watching TV? Or
well, there was a gentleman by the name of Rich Byers,
mm-hmm.
who was a friend of ours, who actually wrote that particular song.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and he came up with the concept, and we loved it.
Yeah.
And that's how we did it. There was another song like that, too, for the brothers who ain't here.
This is for the brothers who ain't here. For the strong brothers missing an X. Mentally and physically. Somebody tell me what happened.
Yeah, and that was actually, that was a poem written by Roz Baraka. Roz Baraka, who was the mayor of Newark.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he had written a poem, and he had recited the poem at an event at Howard University, and he just blew the whole arena out. And we was just like, yo. And then one day I was like, yo, if I could make that into a record, it'd be dope. And then I asked him, and we took the poem and just flipped it into what it was.
Was he was at school with you guys?
Yeah, Roz. Yeah. He came in 1986 around the same time we was there.
Wow. You know, ages ago when Derek was on the show, I asked him this, but I was curious for your perspective. What was an in college Diddy like? How was he the same person he is now? How was he different?
I mean, Puffy was very outgoing. Very colorful, just, you know, always dancing. And I mean, he danced very well. So he was always in all the fashion shows. You know, he was very arrogant. There's, you know.
Even at 19 or whatever?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
But he always knew what he wanted. Mm-hmm. He was one of those guys that always, he knew early on that he wanted to have a record label. He was just that type of guy.
Yeah. So when you hooked back up with him to work as part of the production team at Bad Boy, how did that happen? What was the process of reconnecting with him?
When I was working on the Two Kings and a Cypher demo, he told me, he was like, yo, when you're done, make sure you bring it to me.
And he was at Uptown at that point?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I didn't bring it to him. So he kind of, he was kind of upset at me about that for quite a while, you know? So
was there a particular reason, or just you'd had other offers at that point, or?
Well, I mean, I'm not the one that handled the situation. Ah, it was Hakan Slum.
Gotcha.
He's the one that went around to the various labels, and he's the one that got the deal. So that was out of my control.
Right.
Yeah. So when I ran into Puff one time, he was just like, yo, why didn't you, when the record came out, he, you know, face to face, it was like, yo, why didn't you bring it to me? I thought you was going to bring it to me, you know? So he was kind of like, I think he kind of held that against me. Mm-hmm. But when I got to Bad Boy, you know, it was a tough situation for me because him and I, we didn't really have much of a communication factor going on between us. It was tough for me to get production placed.
Yeah, you said you're after your first year or so, you almost left.
Exactly.
Yeah.
How'd you know that?
We hear stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. See, I almost left because I wasn't getting any work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So after Two Kings and a Cypher, after the sophomore album, when things didn't work out and the label got dropped,
mm-hmm.
it being that we were under the label and we lost our deal, I had to go back to my regular job, and DDOT went to New York. And then I got an opportunity to go to L.A. because the R&B group Shy, they had went to Howard at the time, and they had one of the biggest singles out in R&B, and it was a song called If I Ever Fall in Love. The song was huge. I think it was like double platinum or something like that. They was doing it. And I befriended Darnell Van Ransula. He was the lead singer to the group.
Mm-hmm.
But he was very cool with my sister because they were into that whole frat, AKA thing, frat sorority thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I slipped him my demo of some beats when he was in town. And then he called me in L.A. and asked me to come out there. So I flew out there and I hung out with them for like about a week or two. And then he said, hey, man, you know, I like your production. I like the stuff that you're doing. You should think about moving out here because we could do a lot of stuff. So I went back home and I spoke to my boss, and my boss gave me a leave of absence for like 6 months. So I left. I went to L.A., packed up, and we started working on music. So I would get up and I would just make beats every day. And that's all I would do. And then while they were working on their second album, I was able to place two songs on there.
So baby, let's go back. Girl, let's go back. How we used to be. Don't rush any plans. But it's gonna be
But they didn't want to give me production credit. They didn't want to give me production, and they wanted to split everything five ways. But I wasn't cool with that. I was like, well, wait a minute. You know, if I do the production, then right. I should be getting...
You get half, and the other five guys split the other half.
Right. But yeah. their thing was they wanted to split everything. You know, like they had something that they had worked out with them, but they had kind of wanted to tie me in there with them. So I said, you know what? I'll suck this one up. But I wasn't really too happy with it.
Mm-hmm.
And DDOT at the time, he started working with Mary J. Blige, doing a road managing for her. And things were moving over at Bad Boy at that time. So I started doing little work here and there to stay afloat, like Positive K. I had to this record with Positive K. It's a song called It's All Gravy.
It's all gravy. It's real, baby. Do what you gotta do when you gotta do it. It's all gravy. It's real, baby. Do what you gotta do when you gotta do it. It's all gravy. It's real.
When did Sugar come in, the song you did with Sugar? Around that
came
time?
Came after, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then I did a song with Ed O.G. and the Bulldogs. It was a song called Going Out of My Mind.
Bounce like Spalding. Now we all in. Who claiming mine? My frame of mind flipped and dipped, and now I'm out of time.
I think that was the B-side to a maxi single. The RZA and I was on that maxi single. That was early on production of the RZA. I think around the time, probably when Wu-Tang came out.
What's up?
If you get paid like the rent represent.
RZA, then going by Prince Rakim, produced the song As Long As You Know.
Get paid like the rent represent. If you get paid like the rent represent.
Check it out as I freak that nigga beat that.
So Dot was like, hey, man, you need to be coming out to New York because ain't nothing. If you having problems out here, just come out here. There's a lot of stuff going on. So I packed up and I left and I came to New York. But for me, it was like starting over again because when I came to New York, I had to live with my brother. because I had nowhere to stay.
So right.
I was just like, ah, I can't go home to mom. So let me just stay with my brother. At least
not your DJ brother, right? You have a lot of brothers.
So. Yeah. I have a family of like, 8-10 kids.
Right.
Yeah. So yeah, I had a brother that was staying in Mount Vernon. He was into politics and everything. So
I heard you ran into Alicia Keys around that time.
Exactly.
What's the story with that?
Yes. So we'll talk about that at 2.
Yeah.
So while I'm living with my brother, I met Jimmy Henchman.
James Jimmy Henchman Rosemond is a former businessman involved in the music industry and is currently serving 6 life sentences for multiple crimes, although several cases are being appealed or are awaiting retrial. Henchman founded the management company that would come to be Czar Entertainment around 96, and it would eventually manage acts including The Game, Sean Kingston, Brandy, Gucci Mane, Salt-N-Pepa, and Akon. In 2002, he helped negotiate a boxing match between Mike Tyson and Lennox Lewis. In 2012, he was convicted in federal court of drug trafficking, obstruction of justice, firearms violations, and other financial crimes associated with his position as head of a multi-million dollar transnational cocaine selling organization and was later sentenced to life imprisonment. In 2016, he filed an appeal as well as a complaint against a U.S. attorney stemming from testimony that came from the government's lead witness. In a separate incident, Rosemond was charged and eventually convicted with 4 crimes, including murder for hire and conspiracy to commit murder in connection with the death of Lowell Lodi Mac Fletcher, an affiliate of G-Unit. He was sentenced to life in prison plus 20 years for this case. Tupac Shakur believed that Henchman was involved in setting up the shooting and robbery of Shakur at the Quad City Recording Studios in New York in November 94. In 2012, a man named Dexter Isaacs, serving a life sentence for unrelated crimes, claimed that he attacked Shakur that night and that the robbery was indeed orchestrated by Rosemond. His entire legal situation is explored in the 2016 documentary series Unjust Justice, the Jimmy Rosemond Tapes. We'll have a link to a recent interview with Rosemond as well as an article by The Game about him in the show notes.
And did I mention, promise to pay back Jimmy Henchman in due time?
Actually, wow. I had met Jimmy when I was in L.A. I had met Jimmy because he had... D-Dot was shopping my beats around that time because it was like, okay, well, I make the beats, you shop them, we split the production. That's the deal we had. So while D was doing the Mary J. Blige thing, he would shop my tracks for me. He got the stuff over to these two twins. They were called Carl and Franz, and they went to Howard. And Carl had worked for Jimmy Henchman. And Dot got the tape over to Carl, and Jimmy heard it. Jimmy fell in love with the beats, and they wanted me to come out to New York. So I came out there. That's when I knew I had to move back. Because then I saw, okay, this is more opportunities out here.
Right.
So I got to work with Suga for the first time. I knew her back in the day because she was down with Herbie. Mm-hmm. That was one of Herbie's artists. We did the song called What's Up Star. Mm-hmm. And it became the second single to the show soundtrack.
Right.
At the sports bar, honey's everywhere.
But we were going to, Dot and I, we were supposed to sign management with Jimmy. Yeah. But things didn't work out the way that they should have. Mm-hmm. Certain things happened. And Sure. Yeah. So,
well, in some ways, he dodged a bullet, honestly, not being tied up with him.
He was a good dude because he did a lot for me around that time. And he had a lot of opportunities. So a lot could have came out of that.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that things didn't work out, we just decided to move on to Bad Boy. Bad Boy was available. Because Puffy was putting a group together called the Hitmen. And D-Dot was like, yo, yeah, you need to get down with this. And then I said, well, if I'm going to get down, you need to get down too. We need to do this together. Because I didn't really have the tight relationship with Puff like he did.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, me and Puff was cool at the beginning, but we kind of drifted apart.
Right.
But him and Dot maintained that relationship.
Right.
So by him playing the tracks for Puffy, I don't know if Puffy was aware what the situation was between Dot and I, So I said, well, we need to do this together. And D-Dot was kind of skeptical. He didn't want to do it at first because around that time, he wasn't really involved with the production as much. So I was like, nah, we'll figure it out. Whatever we got to do, let's just do it. And so we went out to Trinidad and, I signed my contract. He signed his a little bit later. I signed my contract a lot earlier. We went down to Trinidad. That's how Hypnotize came about.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But the funny thing about it was when I was creating tracks, Puffy didn't like my stuff because it was too dark. I was doing very dark soundtracky type of beats and he wasn't really caring for that. So, a lot of my friends liked it. A lot of other rappers liked it, but it wasn't really fitting the format for Bad Boy for what Puffy wanted at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So, and me, I didn't like to work in the studio much because he had this room called the MIDI room. And that was a room where everybody would come into to make their beats. And I wasn't really comfortable with that. The, the, that was, it was kind of tied into a budget situation where they would come in and whoever made that beat would get charged to that particular artist, whoever the beat went to, mm-hmm. you know, but I would make my beats at home, and that didn't really sit too well with Puff. You know, he kind of wanted me to be in the studio. So he didn't really care much for listening to the stuff that I would get. You know, I would give him the tape and he wouldn't even listen to it. He would just throw it to the side. Or he would just take it and I would say, well, did you listen to the tape? And he would say, oh, I lost it. And one day I kind of found the tape sitting somewhere in the studio. So I kind of figured that he must not have been caring. If I didn't do it in that MIDI room, he wasn't checking for it. Mm-hmm. So I said, well, I'm going to start going straight to the artists. So I went to Mace, went to Black Rob. They started eating my stuff up. Like, yo, this shit is hot. This is hot. Hot. And they started recording it. And the thing about it, those were some of the tracks that I was playing for Puff. One time I actually sat with him in the studio and I played the tracks for him. And then he would pass on them. He'd be like, he would listen to the stuff like maybe 3 seconds and be like, next, next, next. And he would just pass on all my stuff. And it just so happened that there was one particular track that was on there. And it was the David Bowie sample to Been Around the World.
This Mace, you know what I'm saying?
And he passed on it. He was like, next. And I love you, baby.
Crooked ass bitch today, I get you back for this.
I love you, baby.
No, you don't.
You drive me crazy.
That's right.
I'll never betray you.
Next. So I ended up giving it to Mace. And I was giving tracks to Mace, giving tracks to Black Rob. And they would record them.
Did you make stuff for Mace with him in mind? Because I feel like the stuff you did with him is kind of all of a piece. It has a similar aesthetic.
Like Jay Leno. Now all the labels out want to send a memo. To do a remix, y'all, but Mace say N-O. 50 shots fit at you and that's not a whole round. Where I leave the furniture, think it was co-found. Everybody with me want bucks. Walk around platinum linked up with money like green trucks. Shit get too hot, Puff, put the minks up. Come back in the summertime like fuck it, the summertime.
Nah, none of them were made for him. They weren't made for him in mind. But at the time, he was on that whole Murder Mace stuff.
Yeah, he still calls himself Murder Mace in one or two of the early Bad Boy records.
I was murdered for 6 years, ain't no cream from it. Drop murder off Mace, woke up at Teen Summit.
Right, so there was a record that I did. It was called You Don't Want to Hurt Mace. You don't really want to hurt Mace. I think that's what it was, like the last song on the album. But that was the very first song that Mace recorded. And when he recorded the song, Buffy hated it. He felt like it didn't represent the Mace that he wanted. This because Mace was Murder Mace on this record. He was saying stuff like, you need ice picks to bang me, and you know, kind of stuff like that.
KKK's to hang me, insane me. You need ice picks to bang me. Need more than a straight jacket to restrain me. Or more guns with my prince for you to frame me.
And it was very hardcore. So when Puff heard it, he was just like, yo, I hate this record. But Mace loved it.
Right.
Mace was like, nah, you ain't, I'm keeping this record.
Yeah.
So Mace fought for the record. But if you listen to the album, that's the last song on the album. Buffy put that song last on the album. Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's probably the hardest song on the album. Mm-hmm. But those are the kind of tracks that I was making at the time.
Right.
But then when I realized, you know, songs like Been Around the World, that, you know, that formula was like, okay, it was like a winning formula for Puff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
If you had to put it in words, how would you describe that kind of Bad Boy sound or formula that you put together and started doing?
It was a moneymaker, definitely. Mm-hmm. It was just one of those things that you knew when you did it, you had a good chance of having a number one single.
Musically, how could you describe elements of it? Or
yeah, a lot of 48 tracks, believe it or not. Those, a lot of those records were 48 tracks. Even though they sound like loops, we had to dissect the loops and break them up. You had to add bass lines to them. We had to add, you know, sometimes they would be put guitars on them and different elements to fill it up. So if the certain rapper or singer was singing on a record, you're able to put drops in them. Like if you listen to like a Love Like This, like the whole sample is removed at the end and the bass is rocking by itself. It's like boom, 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 boom. And the song is driving itself without the sample. Mm. That's because of the production that went with it. And when you hear records like Hypnotize, the same thing.
can fill you with real millionaire shit. That's cargo, my cargo. 160, swiftly. Wreck it by your new one. The crew run, run, run. The crew run, run. I know you sick of this.
Those records, you know, you could take the bass out, you could take a sample out, and then you hear the drums just riding, and Biggie's just riding on the drums alone, you know? And then there's drops in there. So those records were 48 tracks. A lot went into those records to make them what they are.
Right.
And that's why the production was so lush and fat.
Yeah. One of my favorite songs of yours is Where I'm From. And I wanted to dig into Jay into that whole thing just for a second. He came to Puff, to you guys, to the Hitmen, for his second album. Why? What was he looking for?
I'm not sure. I wasn't instrumental in that part of it. I just know that when Puff came to me, here's the whole story behind. When Mace and everybody else started recording my songs, Puff, he just started to listen. And then when he heard the songs that he passed on, then he wanted them after that. Because once he heard Mace on the record and saw what this record could be, he was like, wow. Okay, well, let me get the second verse. And once he took the second verse to like Been Around the World, then it's like, okay, now this song is going on my album.
And everything ended up on No Way Out. Yeah.
And the same thing about I Love You, Baby. Yo, let me get the second verse on that. Okay, boom. So those songs went on his album. I don't think he really was aware of what my role really was. So I decided to move on. You know, I spoke to my attorney at the time, which was Osei and Woods, Reggie Osei and Ed Woods.
Woods, yeah.
Reggie Osei, who was the combat jack right
now. Of course, yeah. Yep.
So I sat down. So I got my whole, what I was going to say to Puff, I had everything together. So I sat down with him and then I said, look, you know, I've been here for a whole year and I really didn't get much songs placed. And I didn't really tell him that I was about to get out the contract, but I was about to, but I was explaining to him how I didn't really make any money and how I wasn't getting any work. But he stopped me in my tracks and he was like, yo, man, I really like you. And I kind of want to make things work out. I want to change the situation. And why don't you just go ahead and just put everything. We were working with DAP machines at the time. He said, put everything on the DAP machine, put all your hottest joints on your DAP machine and just give them to me. And I'm going to hook you up. I'm going to place a lot of your joints. So, you know, I kind of looked him in his eye and we had this heart to heart, face to face conversation. And I kind of felt that he was sincere about it. This was around the time Biggie had got killed too. So I went home, I put all my stuff on a DAT from the DAT machine, and I gave it to him. And lo and behold, I mean, the song started getting placed. It was just, he had two studios, two operating rooms. He had a Neve room and an SSL room. And one day I walked in there and they were working on all my production. Somebody was writing to one of my songs in the MIDI room. Another song was getting mixed on the A room. On the B room, another rapper was rapping to one of my tracks. And it just became about me. And it was just a good feeling to just see that. And then I was talking to Faith Evans and she was like, yeah, I'm writing to one of your tracks right now. And things just started moving. And then I started sitting with Faith. She would invite me to her sessions because at the time, Faith didn't really invite anybody to her sessions. So I would sit with her and while she was doing records like Love Like This and All Night Long, her and I sat together and we wrote the song together. That was actually my first co-writing credit. But this, I call it the magic DAT. But it's the DAT machine that Puff had, and it was like a go-to DAT for outside production.
Is that where all the LL stuff came from?
Yes. Have a nice and moist, or play paper games and floss the Rolls Royce. Something like a phenomenon, something like a phenomenon. Staring at my ice, smelling my cologne. She lived on Southside, Supreme Team Zone. Forever keeping it locked, it's now time to rock with. Underestimate the Jack the River. So if there were songs that, like, you know, Brian McKnight, if the label came to him for a song and they needed like an up-tempo, he would pull out my DAT and he would take a song from it. So, and that's how I got the song placed with Brian McKnight. And we went out to Philly and we did Boyz II Men, I Can't Let It Go. And we did the R. Kelly song, spending money. So that all these, there were all these songs on this Dat. So Dat knew where the Dat was. So I think, but Puffy didn't want anybody to touch that Dat. Like if, you, if there's any songs came out of that day, he would get pissed off. But Puffy would overlook that particular. There was put that where I'm from. That it was a a sample by the name of an artist called Yvonne Fear that was on. But I never finished the song. It was just bare bones sample.
I really is pissed. Respect this here. Check. I'm from with a hammer.
You know, I mean, I had chopped it up, but it wasn't finished. It had no bass. It had no drums. It had nothing. And apparently, I think Dot may have played it for Jay or something. Jay heard it and picked it. Or whoever was in his entourage. It could have been the A&R, maybe hip-hop, probably one of those guys.
Ron is referring to former Rockefeller Records head of A&R, Kiambo Hip-Hop Joshua. Hip-Hop, if you're listening, give us a call.
They picked the song, and that's how the song got placed.
Mm-hmm. It's such a great beat. And it seems like every couple of years, someone will reuse it.
Yeah, turn it up in headphones. You know, like that should sound like rock music. Uh-oh. Anything.
But it was this interesting story behind that track, though, the way it was done. Mm-hmm. An interesting story behind that track. But talking about that, you know, but sometimes we would sneak songs off the Dat to get placed.
Yeah.
Like when, if Puffy didn't, certain songs that we thought that he would probably overlook, mm-hmm. we would be like, okay, let's play it for this particular artist. Like for instance, Jive Records came to me and D-Dot, and they had a check. I can't remember how much. It was $30,000, $40,000 check. And they were like, look, we want you to do two songs. We want you to do a song for Will Smith. He's doing a soundtrack, Men in Black. And they gave us the first hint. And it was crazy because we were so hot that people were just cutting checks without even hearing beats. They literally came to the studio with the check and was like, look, we want you to do this song for us. And we got this other artist that we got on the label. So I started working on the Men in Black song. But Will Smith decides to leave. I think his contract may have been up. So he left Jive and he goes to, I think it's Sony it was.
Smith said in a 1997 interview with Entertainment Weekly that Jive turned down the theme song to Men in Black, saying it wasn't a hit. Unsurprisingly, Smith's first solo album, Big Willie Style, came out on a new label, Sony.
That situation has just changed. Tony Polkinum ended up producing the song. But that was supposed to, originally we were supposed to produce it because we got paid for it and everything.
Was it going to be a similar?
It was the same exact track.
Same track.
Same exact track. I did the whole thing. It was same exact song.
Wow.
Yeah. But had he not left, that would have been us.
Same song interpolation and all that?
Same song, yep.
Wow.
Yep, same exact song, same sample. But the Jay situation, I just remember coming to the studio and he was working A&R, so he had to be in the studio a lot, taking care of everything. So he couldn't really sit in the session much. So we did the vocals together. And I just remember how Jay did the record. He was very cool, smooth, laid back. And he would listen to the track. And he would pace back and forth in the studio while he would listen to the song. And he would literally put rhymes in his head, like verses. And then he would go in the studio and then he would knock them out, like verse for verse, without writing it on paper. Yeah. And that's how he put that song together.
Wow.
It was just amazing. And then the song had to get dressed up after a while.
Sure. I know you added bass and doubled some of the drums and added some extra kicks and things.
There you go. Yeah. That came after the fact. Yeah. That came for the mix.
Right.
Yeah.
You did a great video recreating it, actually, not that long ago.
Yeah.
The sounds that I use. You got the kick, have the snare, have the hi-hat, you have the sample, you have the bass. And there's one more sound.
Uh-huh.
gives the song the action.
I wanted to ask you about something about I Love You, Baby. I don't even know if you're aware, but Prodigy wrote a book a few years ago, and in it he claims that that was actually Havoc's beat. Havoc got drunk, left a dad at Diddy's studio. First of all, are you even aware that Prodigy had said that?
Yeah, nah, that's not true.
Nah. I mean, I figured it wasn't the case, but I wanted to make it.
Nah, I actually did that track about Vernon.
Speaking of Mount Vernon, what is the Alicia Keys story?
Oh, Alicia Keys, when Hypnotize came out, they were the first people to call me. I forgot the name of the production company. They called me and they wanted me to come work with Alicia Keys. They was like, we got this new artist. She's coming out. She must have been about 16 years old.
Right.
Yeah. And then she would drive up to Mount Vernon, her and her production partner, Crucial. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we became cool. And they would come to my setup was in my bedroom. They would come to my bedroom and then we would work on music together. We would work on tracks. And then I used to have records everywhere. And there was this one particular record by Isaac Hayes. But the way I wanted to do the record for her, it needed more instrumentation. So I said, look, we got to find Isaac Hayes. Isaac Hayes, at the time, he was a radio personality on 98.7 KISS.
Oh, so he was in the city.
Yes. So her production company got in touch with 98.7 KISS and was able to get a hold of Isaac Hayes. So we sat in a meeting with Isaac. He meets Alicia Keys for the first time. His eyes is on Alicia Keys. He's not even paying attention to me. This is my whole idea, production and everything. I'm trying to get this record done. But he's so impressed with her. He's just like, wow, you know? And this is the first time that they're meeting. So we come up with this whole concept of what we're going to do. So then I go back to my crib, started working with the ideas. And then next thing you know, I'm getting calls like, well, you know, we don't have enough money to pay you because we're trying to use Isaac Hayes. But I'm like, but I'm the producer of the record. What's going on here?
Right.
But eventually they just weeded me out. And the next you know, Isaac Hayes is producing the record. Yeah. But that with that record that you hear Isaac Hayes doing, with Felicia was my whole concept and idea.
Oh wow.
Yeah, and they just cut me out of it.
There's so much that you did during that period that I wanted to get into, but there are one or two specific songs. First off, you know, you did a bunch of stuff with LL, Phenomenon, and a whole bunch of things like that. I think that I read you had something to do with Big Old Butt. Is that true?
Yeah, I did the remake of that one. Yeah, I did.
Keisha's got a big old butt. Uh-huh. You know I told you I'd be true.
I told you.
But Keisha's got a big old butt.
That's right.
So I'm leaving you.
Not one of your favorites?
Nah, not really. Nah. I mean, because at the time when it was going on, nobody took it serious.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everybody was chipping in to write the lyrics, but nobody really took this. I think it was just a song just for fun. They asked Puff to do this song for the album. So we just slapped it together and just gave it to them. It was a remake. No big deal.
So it was a remix of the song that you did?
It was a remake. It was a song. It was a song called In the Beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to do remakes. Like, I think Red MF did Rapper's Delight.
Now what you hear is not a test. I'm a rapper to the beat. It's just me, the groove, and my squad. We're going to try to move your feet. See, I am the Dr. Spot, and I like to say hello.
Puffy did Big Old Butt. So somebody else may have did like maybe a Slick Rick record. Remakes of a whole bunch of records. And it was called In the Beginning.
Oh, okay. So Puffy's version of that LL song. Gotcha.
Right.
That makes sense. What was it like for you after so much time in music? Why go back and go to New York Film Academy and go back to school to learn the film business?
Well, that's because I was always into photography. I had a love for film, but really didn't understand how to put it together. And at the time when I had left Bad Boy, I was into going into like producing records for Luther Vandross and Aretha Franklin, Beyonce.
Questioning what this is, if it's sugar to be true. I don't want to fool myself because I'm falling hard for you.
Do you think you could fall for a woman like me? Because I find it hard to trust. I need too much and I really don't believe in love. No, no. Do you think that I could be the girl?
I started doing records like that.
Mm-hmm.
But then I wanted a little bit more. I wanted to try to figure out, well, let me go ahead and start doing try to learn how to make a film because I never really understood how to do it. But I always had an eye for photography. So I decided to go to school. I said, well, let me go ahead and figure this out. And I sat in class while I was doing my production with music, and I took the time out to learn it. And I learned how to edit. I learned how to shoot film, and I just fell in love with it.
You mentioned the records you did with Aretha and Luther. Also, I guess this applies to a certain extent to LSG.
Yeah, yeah, it's another one. Yeah, you got me and where another you one. Want me. Yeah. You can listen to LeVert while leaving the country. And then sweat it out when you're feeling comfy. Or play Gale to the minute that you say you're hungry.
LSG was an R&B supergroup consisting of Gerald LeVert, Keith Sweat, and Johnny Gill. Ron produced their song You Got Me featuring the Lox.
When you're working with artists like that who are veterans and have sort of so many classics under their belts, is it a different process than when you're working with new artists?
Yes, it's different because they have different ways. They have different ways of making music back then, and they keep the same process of how they make music. So in the new age, we started dealing with Pro Tools and stuff like that, and how we stacked vocals even before Pro Tools came in. We would stack them like, we would put an artist in the studio, and they would stack a vocal. They would do like four passes of one note, and then like the mid note, they'll do another four pass, and then like the high note, they'll do four passes of that. So you have like, you know, three-part harmony. And when Luther did it, it tripped me out because he put everybody in the studio. He put Tuatha. Tuatha was the lady who sang Juicy. She was the backup singer for him. And it was Whitney Houston's mother, Sissy Houston, and another gentleman, Fonzie Thornton, which was his best friend, and somebody else. And he threw them all in the studio together. And they all sang different octaves at the same time. And he was just like, one, two, three, go. And they would sing the chorus all at once. But they sang their different harmonies. And that kind of freaked me out because we never did it that way.
Right. And you're like, you all got to get it right at the same time.
Right. But I figured out that that's how they did it the old way.
Mm.
But it worked. It worked. It sounded good. But it was a natural feel. It was very organic.
Was that true with the Aretha record too? There's a lot of backup vocals on that record.
Well, with Aretha, that record, it was called Wonderful, mm-hmm. which won a Grammy, by the way.
Yep. I just gotta let you know,
in case you didn't know. Wonderful won Aretha a Grammy for Best Traditional R&B Performance in 2004.
But that record wasn't for her. It was for another artist. That a gentleman by the name of KP, who was an A&R for, I think, Sony at the time.
Mm-hmm. So it's the guy from Atlanta?
Yes.
Ron is talking about Kawan KP Prather, an executive producer and songwriter who started out as a member of the Dungeon Family affiliated group PA.
And he had a particular artist that he was nurturing. And the song wasn't made for her. She came to my house, recorded the song and everything. But they was having... I guess internal problems. I think they put her on hold, the project or whatever. It was taking too long. So when L.A. Reid heard it, he was just like, yo, he tried to give it to Whitney. No, we started shopping the song. That's what it was. My manager started shopping the song because they were taking too long with it. And we tried to get it to Whitney, but Clive didn't like it.
That's Clive Davis, founder of Whitney's label Arista Records and a guiding force throughout her career.
When L.A. heard it, he gave it to Aretha. And Aretha took the record. But when Aretha sat, we kept everything on the record, the background vocal.
Oh, okay.
And Aretha just did the lead.
Gotcha.
But the lead was so strong that it didn't matter.
Right.
It just dominated the whole song.
Right. You know, I couldn't let the opportunity to have you here pass without asking about one of your most iconic songs, which is Money, Power, Respect.
Money, power, respect. Eating right. Money, power, respect. Money, power,
yeah.
Respect.
Yeah.
Money,
power, yo, my whole clique bout it. We take yours while you pout about it. Truck, step out, the whores wanna crowd around it. You could see me on Optimum TV. I'm on your bathroom, turn the light out, scream, bloody man.
Can you take me through the making of that tune?
Yes, okay, yeah, all right. From the beginning.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, we were in a studio. We were in the MIDI room, Daddy's House MIDI room. And we were just trying to come up with some hot stuff. It was just like one of them sessions. There was really nothing in particular. We was just like trying to figure figure something out.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a friend of mine by the name of Jay Garfield who carried records around. Sometimes he would dig and he would find some good stuff, interesting stuff. So I was like, yo, Jay, what you got? You know? So he pulled out some of his stuff and then we would listen. And one of the records he pulled out was Money, Power, and Respect. It was a record by Dexter Wanzel. I put the record on the turntable, the Technique 1200, sampled it, caught it on a snare. Caught it on a snare. Yeah, so then Dita got on top of it. And Dita started hitting it. Right? And then we started recording it. So D and I, we structured the skeleton together. We structured the whole skeleton of the song together.
Mm-hmm.
But we kind of got, after a while, we just got producer's block. We didn't know where to take it at that point. Once it must have been about a 16 bar sequence or something like that,
mm-hmm,
before the turnaround. Or was it 8? I can't remember what it was. So D-Dot took the track and gave it to the Lox. But that point, I don't know how that happened. I just know the Lox got the record. But I wasn't there for the recording when they actually did the actual vocals.
Right.
But I got the call at the last minute when they wanted to mix the song because the engineer was Tony Maserati.
Tony Maserati is a producer and engineer who has worked with nearly every important artist from the late 1980s onward. His work with Diddy, Biggie, and Mary J. Blige helped shape the sound of Bad Boy. Among the people he's also worked with include James Brown, Beyonce, Lady Gaga, Mariah Carey, Whitney Houston, and Samantha Fox.
No more fun and games of the mind. So I get a call from Tony Maserati, and he picks up the call personally and says, yo, I'm mixing this song, Money, Power, Respect. You know,
did you even know what he meant by that? Because you weren't around when they recorded the vocals.
Yeah. But he didn't say Money, Power, Respect. But the name of the song was at the time, the before we called it. It was the Dexter Wanzel song. But I knew it was mine.
Right.
And I was about to go to sleep. And he was like, yo, this song, I can't mix the song like that. It just has maybe one snare or something. And it's like, there's no way in the world I can mix the song.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to get up out of my bed and I had to come to the studio to finish the song. Yeah, so I had to dress it up.
Mm-hmm.
At the bass, at the kick, the snare. I had to make the song what it is, like the whole body of the song, and finish it off
in the middle of the night.
Yeah. But the song became, you know, just became a monster at that point. And I remember seeing a Lox at a party and telling him about this. I said, "Yo, have you heard the song? Have you heard the finished copy of it?" They was like, "Nah." I was like, yo, you got to hear it. Joint is serious. And they hadn't even heard it. Yeah. They haven't even heard the mix at the time.
Yeah. And that obviously became iconic. So I saw a movie you did recently called The Rap Dimension documentary. It's a pretty fascinating movie that is about kind of the precursors to rap, I guess you could say, starting in the 1930s, 1940s in music and in dance.
You were given the chance to travel further back, way back, 1970s, 60s, 50s, 40s, 30s, and 20s. What if you could experience rap in that era of time? What would you do? What would you say? How would you react? Tap into your imagination. You're about to witness the rap dimension.
Come on, man. I don't
know what you're doing. What inspired you to make a movie about that?
I'm a researcher. Yeah. So I've been researching that for years.
Mm-hmm.
And I always wanted to do something with it. So I started digging and started finding a lot of stuff because I would watch old movies. And because back, what I'd realized was back then when blacks were involved in movies, it was always musical for the most part.
Right.
And if it was a drama, there was
a sequence in the middle of the movie or a song. Yeah,
exactly. It was always dancing or singing.
Yeah.
Or it was always a musical. Always. So I knew to look for those movies. And when you would find them, and even if it was like an all white movie and there was like there'd be like a part in there where you would have a musical theme.
Right.
And
they'd
be like
go to the nightclub or something.
Right. Yeah. And then a black performer's performing.
Right.
Right. So in some of those movies, you would find some of those parts in there.
Mm-hmm.
So I would go through a lot of those movies and and find a lot of stuff. And that's how I came up with Rap Dimension, and didn't even realize a lot of that existed back then.
Right.
They were actually putting rhymes together. It was amazing.
Now if you want to get to heaven, I tell you what to do. You put on a sock, the boot and the shoe. You place a bottle of corn in your right hand. That'll pass you right over in the promised land.
Yeah, it opened my eyes.
Can you talk about that for a second? Do you see a through line there? You have the gospel quartets, you know, they'd have the occasional song where they would rhyme a funny story instead of singing. Mm-hmm. You can find examples like that all the way up through the mid-1970s, at which point people were actually starting to put rap music together.
Yeah.
Do you see that as a history, or do you see that as just, you know, a bunch of examples that, you know, later you can kind of go back?
Well, no, there's a history to it. It's just like breakdancing.
Mm-hmm.
To me, those things, it's been there for the longest. Nothing new under the sun. It's just that it's just told to another generation at another time. But like your grandfather may have been doing it, and maybe he may have passed it on to his son or whatever. And then somehow a lot of that stuff gets picked up into our time. But then we think it's something new,
mm-hmm.
but it's not. And the same thing goes for rap. I mean, if you dig deep, you'll find a lot of this stuff has been going on for a very long time. Yeah, well, if you listen to early rap, you can hear a lot of the influence on where most of that stuff came from. There's definitely some type of road path passed down. When you hear Rapper's Delight and you hear the Golden Gate Quartet,
mm-hmm.
you hear the similarities, right? Then you hear H-Rap Brown.
Mm-hmm.
Who was a poet.
Right.
And he says, I'm the imp, the dimp, the lady's pimp, the woman's fight for my delight.
The dimp, the lady's pimp, the women fight for my delight, but I'm the grand...
H-Rap Brown, former chairman of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC, was in jail with the older brother of Raheem of the Furious Five. Big Bank Hank of the Sugar Hill Gang, in turn, got the phrase from Raheem. You can hear Raheem himself talk about this on episode 49.
So, hey, I mean, this stuff has been going on for years.
Yeah. When you were researching that stuff, what was... one example of this precursor to rap that really turned your head around?
Definitely the Golden Gate Quartet. Mm-hmm. That's what really opened up my eyes. That one right there.
Do you remember the name of the track? I know you have it in the movie.
I think it was Preacher and the Bear.
Now, fellas, the story I want you to hear is about a preacher what got in a fight with a bear. Listen close, I don't want you to miss this year's story, cause it goes like this. A preacher went out a-hunting one day, 'twas on one Sunday morn. And although he was a Christian gent, he took his gun along. Now, he shot him a bunch of nice fine quails and shot some nice fat hares. But through the woods, returning home, he met a great big grizzly bear. He needed that hole.
Preacher and the Bear. And that was like maybe about a good 5 years ago when I first saw that.
Mm-hmm.
Now you see that in everybody's documentary.
Founding Fathers, which we addressed at the beginning, this documentary you made about the history of, for lack of a better word, the prehistory of hip hop in Brooklyn and Queens. Why do you think that in the popular imagination, that history is kind of glossed over for what happened in the Bronx?
I mean, I think basically, you know, the way the story is told, once everything started popping
mm-hmm.
from the Bronx, I think once it came out of the Bronx, I think it was polished. You know, and then the cameras were on them because it had a platform. You had the scratches, you had the perfect rhymes, you had everything was just put together. When it was in Queens, it wasn't well nurtured and formatted the way the Bronx had it. You know, we had our own style. Brooklyn had our own style. But the Bronx, they took it to another level. And it was just, you know, the timing was just perfect.
And one other documentary you did, which, full disclosure, I have not seen, was about Guy Fisher.
Oh, yeah, Commutation, yeah.
Well, Guy, he was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole.
Guy Fisher was a member of the Council, an African-American crime organization that controlled the heroin trade in Harlem in the 1970s and early 1980s. He was successful enough that he bought Harlem's famed Apollo Theater in 1977. He was convicted in 1984 of multiple RICO violations, including drug trafficking and murder, and was sentenced to life without parole. In part, his conviction came from testimony from his former associate, Leroy Nicky Barnes, who entered the witness protection program.
How did you come to make a movie arguing for a commutation of his sentence?
I know his son. His son and I, we went to college together. And we were talking for a few years. And originally, I wanted to do the story about the Apollo Theater. Because the guy actually owned the Apollo.
Right.
And I wanted to do a story about that. That's how it started off. But then it came to the point where his family was gunning for him to come out of jail, because this was the time that Obama was letting a lot of prisoners go mm-hmm. for certain
towards the end of his term situations and stuff.
So we thought Guy fitted that category. And that was also a part of the documentary as well, because I wanted to tie that in at the end. So I said, well, let me just go ahead. Let's just focus on the commutation part and I'll get to the Apollo piece later. Mm-hmm. And that's how that came about.
Okay.
Yeah.
And, you know, what are you working on right now, both musically and in film-wise?
Well, I have a book coming out right now.
Oh.
I'm working on the book. It's called Where I'm From.
Mm-hmm.
It's a pictorial, but this book tells the history of my life. Because when I started off as a kid doing music at the same time, my brother gave me a camera for Christmas. And the funny thing was, I was looking at the videotape a couple of months ago
mm-hmm.
that one of the family members actually videotaped me with a camera in my hand around the Christmas tree. And I was actually opening my gift and pulling out a camera. So that camera was the beginning of my picture taking adventure. And I would take pictures everywhere. I would take pictures no matter where I went. I took pictures at events. And then I brought my camera along to college. And I would tell my friends that I knew Kool G Rap, I knew Eric B, because all these guys lived around me. Eric B lived two blocks away. Kool G Rap lived, you know, down the street. Mm-hmm. And Polo lived not too far. And Herbie and C. Divine and Kid and Play, they all lived around me. So I would tell my friends that, but nobody believed me. This is around a time when we didn't have internet. And we didn't have cable. We had cable TV, but in college, that wasn't readily available.
Sure.
In a dorm. Nobody really knew what they looked like. So for me to take pictures and bring them back was a big deal.
Yeah.
So I would go home and I would carry my camera and I would take it to I would follow my friends to their clubs. We'd go into Latin Quarter and I would take pictures of all of them. And then I would take pictures with Heavy D. I'll take pictures of Rakim and I would bring them back to school. And I would put them in my photo album and everybody would come to my dorm just to see the pictures. And everybody was just like overwhelmed, like, wow, like, you know, they couldn't believe it. And all these pictures piled up after a while. They just started piling up into a photo album. And, you know, when these guys would come to college, they would come visit me and I would take them around. And, you know, Eric B would come and, you know, G-Rap. It was just one of them things. It was just crazy. But, my album started getting thick. Then I had like two big, thick albums. And then when I got to Bad Boy, I started doing the same thing. I started carrying my camera around everywhere I went. I started documenting it just became a habit, but it was for no particular reason. And I just had all these pictures. But then I realized this is my life. I could tell a story. I could literally tell a story with all these pictures. So this is the time for me to release my book and start speaking about it, start doing speeches. Yeah, so this is where I am right now. Well, I come from a neighborhood, it's a middle-class neighborhood, and it's called East Elmhurst. And many people may know it because it's attached to LaGuardia Airport. LaGuardia Airport's within walking distance from my home. And East Elmhurst was a place that when Black people from Harlem, when they got money, they wanted to live in a house. They wanted to have a backyard with a garage and with grass in the front and the fence and the whole nine. And Queens was one of the places that they can go. There was particularly parts of Queens, but in particular, East Elmhurst was a place that opened up the doors to Blacks to be able to live in the middle class area.
Mm-hmm.
So when entertainers started getting money, they started flocking to those areas like East Elmhurst. Louis Armstrong was the first one to come mm-hmm. when he came to the Corona part. And then Ella Fitzgerald followed. And then Dizzy Gillespie followed. And then you had Bill Kenny and the Ink Spots, Nipsey Russell and all these guys. So they all started coming. Frankie Lyman, Harry Belafonte lived on the corner of my block. And Malcolm X lived down the street. I lived on 97th Street and 25th. Malcolm X lived on 97th Street and 23rd Avenue.
Wow.
Yeah. So they called it the Gold Coast. And it had a history because this was like, it was at one point, they called it like the richest neighborhood, richest Black neighborhood in New York City. We had a lot of Black owned businesses. The Nation of Islam was very prominent in the area. So a lot of the money was being passed around throughout the neighborhood.
Yeah.
So they opened up bakeries and they had We had a doctor's office at the corner of my block. A dentist was down the street. We had butcher shops. We had everything, and everything was black owned. Yeah, so it was a flourishing neighborhood. You know, we were the offsprings, and then we came. And then we started with the Eric B's and the Kid and Plays and the Kwame's, and you know, I came along and. You know, the G-Raps and, you know, whoever else came after. But, you know, East Elmhurst has a rich history that a lot of people don't know about that I am proud of. Yeah.
You ever think about documenting that?
Yes, definitely.
So that's maybe down the line as some kind of documentary or book or something.
Yeah, definitely documentary. Yeah.
Wow. I think that our producer, Josh, is going to kill me if I don't ask about Hypnotize specifically. So there were reportedly some issues getting sample clearance around that. Was that anything you had anything to do with?
Well, the only thing that I know is that originally Herb Alpert and his partner, and from what I can remember, was I think his partner didn't want to be involved, didn't want the song to be involved in a rap record.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of the reasons why.
Not a common thing for that songs, era.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And Herb Alpert was like kind of fought for it. Yeah.
According to Herb Alpert's nephew, Randy Alpert, who was one of the writers on the 1979 track Rise that Ron sampled to make Hypnotize, they had been approached by as many as 8 to 10 artists for permission to use it previously, but had never granted clearance because they didn't like the previous songs. Randy said he actually was a big fan of Biggie's first album, and as soon as he put on the tape of Hypnotize, he knew it would be a hit. He was, of course, correct. His trumpet-playing Uncle Herb hit number one with the original and is the A in A&M Records.
You know, later on down the line, he thanked us for it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because the record, I mean, till this day, this record is making money. It's an Oreo commercial.
Come on. Oreo Thins. A thin twist on the Oreo cookie you love.
It's in Baywatch.
We got a dead body on our beach.
That's not our job.
My gut says there's some bad shit going on over there.
It's in a lot of stuff. So, I mean, it's been great for me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You remember first hearing the finished version of that? Do you remember what your thoughts were?
Man, when I first, what? Ridiculous. Ridiculous. I just remember creating the song. But when, you know, when those songs were being created, especially like Hypnotize,
yeah,
you just had no idea. I had no idea the song was going to be for Biggie. The way I found out was when we were leaving. See, Puffy liked it so much because after the record was created in Trinidad and we went to lay it down, I just remember how Puff was going crazy. And he was saying, yo, this right here is going to be Biggie's first single. Like, he already said it before even Biggie put the lyrics on it, that he knew that would be Biggie's first single.
Mm.
And while we were getting on a plane to go back to New York, that's Biggie's first single. I was
no idea for the hook yet. No, nothing.
Nothing.
Yeah. Amazing. So I know you actually had some health issues. You are a cancer survivor. Can you tell me a little bit how you found out, how you overcame it?
Yeah. Well, 2016 was a rough year for me.
Mm-hmm.
That was a year that I had to reflect. Yeah, I went through the battle of cancer and I overcame it. I went through different treatments, radiation, chemo, and just the hardship of just trying to get my life back, you know, on track. Yeah. But, you know, but for that year, it just kind of just, you know, it took me for a loop and I had to kind of just lay back and, just regroup, get my energy back. Cause you know, cancer, it sets you back, you know?
Of course.
So, but like, anybody else that gets it, it's just a low blow. But it was definitely a wake up call, and I overcame it.
Wow.
So I'm just happy to happy to be strong and healthy again.
Yeah, congratulations.
Thank you.
That's amazing. But it was most of last year that you spent kind of battling it.
Yes, but the whole year. I found out the top of 2016, the January 2016. That's when I found out. Yeah, and then I started treatment in around April. Then I went to operation in June, and then I did the chemo in July, mm-hmm. Finished in October.
Well, I'm glad that you beat it and are healthy. Did you connect with other people who were going through similar disease at the time you were fighting it?
Oh, no, not at all.
Mm-hmm.
No, I just really it was, I just stayed to myself and I was just close to the family. Mm. Yeah. And, you know, I have close friends that I spoke to, another friend of mine who had kind of went through it and he kind of gave me some advice and encouragement. And I speak to him a lot to this day.
Wow. What kind of stuff really got you through it? What kind of kept your head on straight while you were battling it?
Well, one thing that I said to myself was that, you know, I realized that everybody is dealt with something. Like, we all have to have something at the end of the day. Like, we, you know, we all may die of something, or we're all going to get something one day, whether it's high blood pressure, diabetes, a stroke, or cancer of this, cancer of that. We're going to get something. So I mean, very few people just die of natural causes, mm-hmm. or just don't get anything at all. So as you age, you're going to have something. So I thought about that and I said to myself, well, you know, this is what I'm dealt with and this is the time. I just have to just go battle it and just deal with it. But so I wasn't sorry for myself. I just knew that somewhere along the line, something was going to happen. But now was the time where I was dealing with this. So I told everybody else, don't feel sorry for me. You know, I don't want you to feel sorry for me. This is what I'm dealing with now. And just understand that everybody has to go through something. Yeah.
Well, congratulations. I'm glad you beat it and that you're well. So are you still making beats? Are you still doing music these days?
Yeah. I still make music. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I've been creating with softwares lately, with Pro Tools and Logic and stuff like that. But I'm looking into getting one of those MPC studios. I want to kind of pound on the pads again because I kind of missed that. Yeah. Well, I haven't done that in a while. But I'm into, like, you know, the production and the visuals at the same time. Yeah, that's what I love.
Interesting. Well, I can't wait to see what comes of it. Ron Amon-Ra Lawrence, thank you so much for coming by.
Appreciate it.
One of the best things about talking to Ron was his real love for music and history, something I can definitely relate to. It was great to watch his documentaries and see his passion for the underappreciated prehistory of hip-hop. I was very glad to be able to dig into that topic with him. And of course, I loved hearing about his early days working with Herbie Lovebug and how he made all those iconic records with Bad Boy. I will never tire of asking anyone who had anything to do with it about where I'm from. Jay, if you're listening, you're next up. From Salt and Peppa to Gamble and Huff to Diddy to Aretha, Ron has a diverse musical background, and that's led to him being able to work with an incredibly wide variety of artists and still always sound like himself. Join us next week when our guest will be Tom Silverman. He's the Tommy in Tommy Boy Records. We'll talk about the founding of the label with Planet Rock and other early dance and electro hits, its transition into golden age iconic acts like Digital Underground and Queen Latifah, and also get into the creation of the history-making New Music Seminar. To make sure you hear each episode of The Cypher as soon as it comes out, subscribe on Apple Podcasts or your podcast app of choice. That's a good opportunity to check out our back catalog. If you like this episode, you should listen to our talk with Ron Lawrence's partner in crime, Derek Angeletti, on episode 21. Whatever you use to listen to the show, Apple's podcast, Google Play, seriously, whatever, go now and give us a rating and a review. It helps us bring more fans and attention to the show. And you can really help us by becoming a patron. Visit us at patreon.com/thecyphershow and sign up. Bringing you a weekly show takes at least 20 hours a week, and we could really use the support. If even 20% of you gave us just $1 a month, we could at least afford to eat while researching and editing. As an added bonus for our patrons, every month we share extra audio that we get from our guests, either when talking to them after the main interview is over, or sometimes when they give us some extra special material. Join by the end of June to have access to July's file. Previous months have included unreleased music from the likes of the Wu-Tang Clan and Chuck D. If you want to talk to us about the show, visit us on social media. We're at The Cypher Show on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Let us know what you thought of this episode and who you'd like to see on the show in the future. More information about anything related to the podcast, playlists, our complete archives, and more can be found for free at thecyphershow.com. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sotero.
Yeah, that's what I love.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
I mean, lyrically, he was better than I was.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
And he had this dog called Cyborg.
Our web guru is Aaron Young.
You should think about moving out here.
Audio assistance by Rob Van Vranken.
I don't think he really was aware of what my role really was.
Extra special thanks to our recording consultant, Florence Burrow Adams.
So when you listen to it very low, you should be able to hear almost everything.
Special thanks to Patreon supporter, Sanchon Dilip Jones.
Yeah, and he came up with the concept, and we loved it.
We'll see you next time around on The Cypher.
There was so much more that I wanted to say.